Welcome back, listeners of the Skulls Cast. My name is Kaz.
This is Medibot.
And this is episode 54 of the cast, wherein Medibot and myself discuss something very near and dear to his shriveled, black, bilious, hateful heart. And possibly
Don't forget Metallic.
And also possibly near and dear to my own. I don't know yet, because Medibot has kept a lot of the information secret.
Yes.
But before we get to that, we have Skulls Asked.
We've received many delightful questions from presumably people. So let's answer them, why not, maybe. This question for the Skulls Asked comes in from Vicetron. Vicetron asks, what is it that makes Kirby games so much fun?
I would, in a word, theming.
I think my answer is sort of the same, but the word I would pick is hugs.
Hmm. With theming, every single part of the Kirby game feels like it belongs. And this isn't an accident. They spend a whole hell of a lot of their time with Kirby games developing not only the rules and the system, but also all of the little flares and polish and effects and sounds, all of the menus, all of the phrasing of words inside the menus. All of it feels like it belongs because it's all part of a continuous theme. We don't need a continuing overarching plot. We don't need anything more complex than that dag nasty day-to-day has stolen all of the food in the entire world. We have to get it back.
Let's go get him.
Go get him!
Rough him up.
It's like, him bad, go get him. And that's all you need. And, you know, they play with it more from there. But everything that you encounter along the way belongs to this world, fully and completely. That's why it's so fun.
Kirby games are fun because they're full of things that are in Kirby games. And I guess that's sort of the same answer. Is that Kirby games have Kirby game rules, and Kirby levels, and Kirby music, and Kirby visuals. It's... everything is designed to make the player feel good, and it works. I play it and I feel good. It's not some dumb emotional trick where it's tricking me into feeling good. I feel actually good, and I walk away and I still feel good. I carry that good Kirby feeling with me.
I think it's this reason that has allowed Kirby games to have the most successful streak of co-op console playing experiences.
Yes. Even though Return to Dreamland gets a little hectic with four drivers all at their respective wheels.
But it was so much fun!
Right, well, I mean, we did it with
three. Wow!
And that was mostly hectic, and we sometimes killed each other.
Yes. But there wasn't the same kind of menace that existed in, say, New Super Mario Bros. Wii. That was full of menace.
That was full of bile.
If you did not understand the rules completely and perfectly, You would lose, and then you would be in the bubble.
Right,
you
would die or be severely punished.
Yeah.
Whereas in this one, if someone doesn't know the rules, they catch up to you.
You sort of bounce back.
Yeah.
You're given many second chances and opportunities because the theme does not contain that sense of bilious competition,
right,
and hate. I don't think there's any hate anywhere in those games.
Although it's interesting to realize, let's think about these two games for a moment. In New Super Mario Bros. Wii, everyone has their own life total. In Kirby's Return to Dreamland, it is shared. And so when someone else dies in Mario Bros., the other three players feel like they are not affected by this. He died. Oh, too bad for him. When your friend dies in Return to Dreamland, that hurts the group.
Yeah, there's no shared stake in what's going on. I honestly don't know how much that simple change would do to help out New Super Mario Bros. Wii.
I'm not sure.
Like...
Well, it's also a lot easier to interact with other characters in deadly ways, vis-a-vis shells.
Yeah. I mean, there's too much else that's built in, almost with the malicious intent
yes.
into the game. It's like, oh, I can shove him into pits, or just run fast, and then he dies. That's what really got me.
Right.
It's that the camera followed the guy who was in front at the expense of all others.
Right. Another interesting thing to note is that in Return to Dreamland and not in Mario Bros. Wii, at the end of each level, it tells you how many stars each character collected and how many enemies each character defeated. So it seems that it's almost sort of encouraging you to compete on that front. Which is to say, but these are both useful things to do. In the game, when you defeat an enemy, that helps the group. When you collect stars, that helps the group. And so, you know, you can race.
Yeah,
try
I mean, good-natured and good-spirited competition.
Right.
Strong theming.
Consistency.
Like,
the competition
lack
leads
of bile.
To a mutual goal.
These are all reasons that Kirby games are fun.
Yes.
In ways that other games aren't.
Perhaps. Also, to restore your friend's health, you give him a smooch.
Smooches.
I will play Kirby game with you anytime.
There are certain times of the day I will not play Kirby game with you. I have to sleep.
I will wake up. Let's go to our next question.
Well, our next question comes from Hold On Juicely and is part of the theme. Ho! Who asks, if you could invent your ideal Kirby power that's never been done yet in a Kirby game, what would it be like, and what would it be called?
Oh god, that's really hard. I've actually tried to think about this before.
Oh, you have? Okay, well, I've thought about it before too, because I've been, like, doodling this since I was a kid and played Kirby's Adventure once, and I was like, wow, wouldn't it be cool if Kirby did? And then he would have, like, a hat. And, I came up with back then, and still continue to come up with this day, axe.
Yeah, you've got axe power.
It would be like an axe, and it would be called axe.
Well, you have a little Viking helmet? That would be cute.
Yeah, yeah. He would either have that, or whatever helmet the little, like, skull-faced guys have who wield axes, because he's definitely going to have to, like, eat one of those in order
yeah.
to get it. Or, if he can't eat them, he'll have to, like, get a copy power and, like, scan the guy, and then he'd be like, oh, man,
maybe
I
there's, like, a mid-boss you can get it from. And...
I think that axe would be sort of a midpoint between hammer and sword. Mm. So it would be kind of slow, kind of lumbering. It would be a cutting power, so it would be able to slice things. I think that we could split up some... take some powers from either sword or cutter, depending on which one, like, feels correct.
Axe power.
Yeah.
The problem is
I think
of things, and then I realize that I'm thinking of them because I played a game with that power in it.
We could also put in things that specifically axe solves, and other things only, like, make, you know, if you use regular cutting powers, it'll make little slices in it, but it won't work. And if you use hammer or, like, heavy things, it'll, like, push the thing, but then it'll bounce back. But if you use axe, which is a combination of cutting and power, then it'll cut the bouncy tree.
It'll cut the rubber tree in half.
Yeah.
So we're also adding in this new puzzle solve vector that axe. There are some puzzles that are axe puzzles. That I don't know if I like.
What the hell is wrong with it?
Here's what's wrong with it. Because when we have a cutting puzzle, there are a bunch of powers that cut. When we have a burning puzzle, there actually are more than just fire that burns. But here's saying, you know, here's a axe-shaped hole, put an axe in it. And, like, sort of hanging a, this is the only power that fits on it.
So, make it the solution to an optional puzzle.
Okay, sure.
This is how you get 100% completion.
I want...
Boom.
All I can think of are combinations of existing powers. Because I'm really bad at thinking of new things. And I think I sort of, like, imagine... You know, I try to make a new power that's, like, kind of magical, and I end up always creating mirror.
Mm-hmm.
Or I try and make another fast power, and I just make wing and or jet again.
Uh-huh.
I guess, what is really... And then they even added leaf, so I can't try and just, like, go to Pokemon for help here.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
Okay, we'll tell you what. How about you and I invent a power right now?
Okay, let's try to invent a power
right
now.
Let's try to invent a power. And I'll give you categories... And I will limit what you are allowed to do.
Bone power.
Okay. I think we just finished.
It's like spooky, and he has like a little skull. Like he gets it from a skull bone enemy, and he puts a skull over his head.
And then he
throws bones at things. And then can like make a scary face and scare enemies. That would be cute.
Ooh, that would be good. Ooh, you know what we could use that for? Is a puzzle where you have to, like, herd enemies onto a lever.
Right.
So that there's, like,
enough
of them.
You need to weigh something down.
Yeah.
And so you have to convince all the Waddle-Dees to
yeah,
stand
and
on
so,
it
like,
by being terrifying.
Between, like, you and friend and these guys, you have to get enough weight on there.
Yeah.
And you can kind of, like, shove them into place with other powers, maybe.
Yeah.
So there's, like... So
but this gives
your,
you, like, a
no-damage
shove?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, so we got, like, bone powers,
bone
skeleton
power.
You
just turn Kirby into the Diablo 3 Witch Doctor, and I am totally on board.
Okay, great, let's do that.
Maybe we can have, like, little spirits coming up from underneath the skull.
Maybe, I mean, there's already ghost power.
There is already ghost power, and I haven't played that game yet.
Alright, I'll let you borrow it sometime. It's mostly worth playing this game to get ghost power
maybe,
because it's very cute.
I think
cute.
That in like within the game, it would be called either like spooky or horror.
Fright
power.
Yeah.
And then you could have like a whole Halloween-themed world, which would still be perfectly in keeping.
Yeah, you can have a spooky town set of levels in a Kirby game. That's fine.
Yeah.
Well, just a couple spooky town like levels here and there, and so it's a sort of an uncommon power.
But I think that more or less does it. So there you go.
Excellent.
Axe and skull. That is what we would invent.
We like to play very manly video games. Kirby is a game for very strong players. Those are
right,
all
so
the questions that we have answered.
That's all
of
the
questions.
Skulls ask. So, on to the delightful topic of discussion for...
Tonight's topic
for tonight.
Of discussion is dungeons in video games. And I guess also non-video games.
Mm.
And why everyone fucks them up, and why I'm mad about it, and why a few games have done it pretty close to right.
You have to be kind of careful when you broach this topic with someone who's... I hate to use this word or even engender its use, but a non-gamer.
Yes.
Because dungeon has another meaning in the real world. And one that you don't mean, and that people will think about. So you have to be careful.
Right. I'm talking about dungeons...
We're talking about, you know, playing D&D
right. In the
and
context of games,
encountering
typically in the context of games
searching for hidden
that
rooms and that
about
kind of shit.
you know, exploring.
We're not talking about strapping on oddly shaped leather clothes and going to somebody's basement named Madame Couturier and...
That may be part of this dungeon, but it's usually not.
I really hope you're not really talking about the same Madame Couturier that I'm talking... Let's talk about your dungeons.
Let's talk about my dungeons. Dungeons were invented long ago, of course, and they weren't as much fun back then, because you would get thrown in one and then you'd die. Modernly, they are different, because they are video games where your character gets thrown in one and then dies. Which is a lot more fun. Specifically,
yeah,
they die to monsters or traps or hazards or starvation or... Their head catches fire, they catch a bad cold or something.
It's more fun to talk about oubliettes than to be in one.
Yes.
So I hear.
And one of the more, I guess, classical dungeon games is your net hack based off of rogue. It's a very basic game. The idea is that you are a, you know, fantasy adventurer of some stripe, be it a dashing swordsman or, you know, powerful wizard or what have you, and you have been tasked to enter this dungeon and slay monsters and retrieve treasure and try not to die. And the way a lot of these games work is that every time you start a new game, some aspects of the game are randomized. But not always, and not all, and some aspects will be the same every time. And so your goal is to just, you know, do well with whatever the dungeon throws at you.
Now, is that an implicit part of what we're talking about? Are we really talking about just procedurally generated?
No, we are not,
you know,
only talking about procedurally generated dungeons. Some dungeons are the same every time, and that's also okay.
Right, but I mean for the entire game, say. So if we were talking about a game where there is a dungeon and it's always the same, you are a character who always has the same powers. The dungeon is always the same way, and that's...
We're not as much talking about that
because that's arguably Metroid.
You know,
that's a dungeon. You go down.
It is a
dark
dungeon.
There's scary shit in there. You'll die.
Right.
But it's always the same. There's all of the power-ups are in the same place, and the level designers can design around that.
Right.
So I actually, for the purpose of the conversation, want to limit us to talking about the ones where that is not the case.
Right.
Where it is procedurally generated or otherwise random or somehow a unique experience every time.
Right. And here's...
Let's talk about that.
Let's talk about procedurally generated dungeons and why they're basically always... If they try and be anything more than very simple, they are usually bad. Because when you try and do something non-simple with a procedural, you know, room generation algorithm, you end up with a right mess that, if you're not careful, will sometimes just be impossible, or the difficulty of a given game will vary wildly based on just how your generator behaves. And when the difficulty variance is too great, people are not going to like that. They're going to just restart the game until they get an easier set of initial circumstances, which is a bad sign in games, and in many games, this is considered essentially cheating at them. But if I'm cheating because something is making me upset, you know, that's not entirely on me as the player. So we generate these random rooms, and there are consistent things about them. And, you know, I have to explore and sort of map out as I go. You know, I sort of generate a map by just finding things, and then, okay, now they're on my map, or whatever. And I'm also defeating monsters, I'm getting in fights with monsters, and that allows me to grow in power, and as I go further down the dungeon, the monsters also grow in power. And so, by the end of the game...
Right, so So at any step, we can't know, like, specifically what the player power is, how many rooms they've been through, how many monsters they've slain, but on an average, right, we can control
that. I can say, okay, you know, starting at the third floor, these guys show up.
Yeah, and even more than that, to kind of...
For instance, the monster generation algorithm in NetHack has two inputs to it, the floor of the dungeon you're on, and whatever your current character level is. So it does sort of tweak to however you are doing at the time, but if you just shoot straight down without gaining any levels, pretty soon you're going to be out of your depth.
Yeah.
And you will die.
There are other ways to handle that without actually, like, reading input from the player.
Right.
It's just the amount of stuff, the beneficial stuff that you give the player can be, if not strictly controlled, it can be, like, variably controlled. Right. You can figure out averages. You can figure out min and maximum, right, and you can tweak those. It's kind of distant, and you have to be really handy with good probability, and your player base also has to be pretty handy with probability and statistics to be able to enjoy it. But there is a payoff. I don't think... we might not be ready to talk about the payoff of that just yet,
not
but
yet.
There we are. So we have a Dern dungeon, and it's generated, right, and... yeah.
And so here's the problem with NetHack and the games like that where, you know, you're just this one guy and you're going down in the dungeon, whatever. Here are the problems. These games are basically based off Dungeons & Dragons.
Yes.
And when you play Dungeons & Dragons, you know, you have your big old rule book that tells you basically how everything works.
Sometimes absurdly big.
Right.
Yes.
Whereas in a game like your Rogue or your NetHack or any of these other rogue-like games, as they are called, a lot of the time, the game doesn't come with the rulebook. You have to figure things out by experimenting and dying and losing characters and keeping copious notes and essentially generating the rulebook by trial and error, or by looking it up on essentially a spoiler site.
Yes.
So we intentionally do not give the players some of this information and then pretend like it's some sort of interesting discovery when really this is sort of a basic vital game mechanic and I should, you know, in a actual D&D setting, I would simply know this because it's in the rules, unless it's something that my DM has created specifically for this game, and it's not in the rules. At which point, my DM's motives become suspect. Is he trying to trick me into killing myself? Mm. When I beat NetHack, I did it with spoilers. When most people begin to play NetHack, they do it with spoilers. There has basically been one documented case, maybe a few more that I don't know about, of someone who has beaten NetHack, and we know that they did not ever consult spoilers.
That's kind of a weird thing to achieve.
It is. And I think it sort of says how much the game sort of suffers from... Well, I mean, suffers insofar as you have to go and look on some external website for all this information that you basically need to beat the game.
Yeah, I mean, what have you really accomplished at that point?
You know, player just going in blind going to know that on the bottom floor of Gehenna, they need to step on a square that will vibrate and then light use 7 candles on the candelabrum of the undead, ring the bell of opening, and then read from the Book of the Dead?
Are there any in-game mechanisms for learning these arcana?
The closest thing we have to that, are the fact that when you get these items, the person who gives them to you says it's important, and there is an oracle who you can give money to, and they will give you a random message that is usually helpful.
Oh. So, sort of.
Sort of. The other problem with making this game based off of D&D is that D&D is a team exercise. This is a single-player game.
And really, the only fun I ever had in D&D was playing with my buds.
Right.
Getting together with friends, talking, shooting the breeze, pretending to be wizards.
Pretending to... You play your elf game, and you have a great time playing elf game. It's great. You know, whatever elf game you like best, whatever elf game you have fun with, play that elf game.
Now it is time for the real magic.
Yes. So, NetHack is full of lots of idiotic bullshit that you have to look up in a spoiler. Also, it's a game of locks and keys, where before you get past a certain point in the game, you need to have a certain set of metaphorical keys in the sense of certain abilities and pieces of equipment, or you will just lose to stuff that comes out of nowhere and kills you in one turn.
I did, you know, the last time you described all that shit to me, I did mean to ask you something, but I only figured out the question a long time afterward.
Mm. What did you mean to ask me?
I know you, and I know how you play games.
Yes.
And any game that offers you defensive capabilities, an ability to shield yourself, protection from something, or a way to ignore stuff, is the kind of thing that you prefer.
Yes. I like playing survivability and...
Almost to an absurd degree,
yes.
Even if the game isn't really built for
yes.
that. So I meant to ask, aren't there other ways to do this? For example, could you, in turn, pull some radical maneuver and murder this demi-lich before his things happen? Could you lure him into a pit of lava, or mind-slave him, or something? I mean, aren't there alternatives to having
yes.
these protections that you seek?
There are. Here's the problem with that. The sort of more minor problem is that if they get the jump on you, then they get to go first and they kill you.
Yeah, I mean, sure.
But there are also means you can use so that things get the jump on you less. You can detect monsters from further away and sort of know that they're coming and avoid their line of sight and what have you. The bigger problem is that, sure, you know, you can point your death ray wand at the lich, and the lich is dead, and you're alive, and your death ray wand has one fewer charge in it. Better keep going. Your resources are much more limited, and because of just the quantity of dangerous situations you will find yourself in, it's usually not a great idea to whip out your biggest guns immediately, unless not doing it will be lethal. And so, rather than...
I'm still suspicious of that as well.
So my choices are, I carry around this wand of death, and the ninth lich kills me. Or I get a robe of liches can't kill me. And then I just punch them to death or whatever.
But each of those is equally costly? I don't believe that that's the case.
It's actually easier to get that robe most of the time.
Oh, man.
Wizards start
okay,
with
so
one.
Maybe they get... Alright, so at this point I have to admit that perhaps the game is designed for the hyper-conservative, never spend any resource that you don't have to, and get every possible protection against everything
yes.
that you can style of play.
Yes.
I am suspicious of this just from the source.
That's fair.
Because
I'm very unreliable.
You are, and also you're my only source for information about NetHack. I don't care enough to learn from anyone else or to investigate on my own. I mean, from my own perspective, I played NetHack for the space of perhaps 2 minutes.
Yes, that's probably enough.
Most of it spent in character creation, making choices I didn't understand, and then just being baffled by the base controls of the game.
It is definitely really a game from, you know, the 70s and 80s in that regard.
And I'm like, wait, how do you control this? Wait, what do you mean I have to have, like, a patch to be able to use the arrow keys? The hell?
It's very
What
silly.
Is this? Why am I staring at a whole screen of characters? Why am I the letter H? What is going on?
You're the at sign.
I was at? I thought I was H. I thought I was a dwarf. And
right, except the player H. character is always an at sign. Other dwarves will be H's for small humanoid.
Oh, but I'll still die if I try to murder all mind flayers?
Yes, if you try to murder all lowercase H's, that includes you.
Even though I'm not a lowercase H, but the at sign.
Right. Because it kills dwarves and you're a dwarf.
But I said mind flayers.
You just say mind flayers, but then watch out for master mind flayers.
Oh, their H.
Yeah, they're also a lowercase H.
Oh.
Here's a thing that NetHack does right that I didn't appreciate until I played a game that did it wrong. So maybe let's talk about
the game
that did it wrong. Let's talk about the Dungeons of Dreadmoor. Which is a game that, in most regards, I like a lot, if my Steam playtime is any indication of it. It's got a classless character creation system. You just pick skills. So there are a lot of skill combinations that are just wrong, and you'll die. But it also gives you a lot of versatility once you've sort of figured things out. You can go a bunch of different directions with that. And it also puts you in a procedural dungeon, and you're all by your lonesome, and there are a ton of monsters, and they all want you very, very dead, and you have to get to the bottom, and in this case, you have to kill a powerful boss monster, and that's the end goal.
Dreadmoor, as it were.
Dreadmoor. Yes, Lord Dreadmoor. And you have, magic powers, and fightery powers, and sneaky powers, and lots of different little things you can do, and those silly items, and there are little clever jokes all over, and it's full of cheese and alcohol, and you use alcohol to do magic. And your wizard casts a math spell, and I clap with glee at my math spell that I have just cast. And here's the game's problem that it does wrong that NetHack did right. In both games, in both Dreadmoor and NetHack, it's turn-based, and you're moving around the dungeon, and it's this fixed grid, and, you get a step, the monsters get a step, and you take turns like that. And over time, your character will regenerate their hit points. Just healing over time. And that's fine. It's fine to heal over time. Here's the problem. In NetHack, this is not always this is not a free choice. Not least of which because, a monster might sneak up on you while you're sitting there resting, or what have you. Even disregarding that. Because in NetHack, you get hungry. In NetHack, you have to eat every so often, or you die of starvation. And sometimes, finding food can actually be a little difficult. But a lot of monsters are edible, so you just kill them and eat them. And you'll find food rations here and there, which are a little more nutritious for you. But it keeps you moving forward, because once you've explored a floor, monsters will spawn there very, very slowly. But if you go to a new floor, there'll be a ton of new monsters there for you to kill and eat. So hunger forces the player to continue moving forward at some rate, or they will die of starvation. And Dreadmoor lacks this. In Dreadmoor, it is always correct from a just sort of optimal beating the, I want to beat the game standpoint, to heal fully between any given fight and the next one by just walking in a circle or standing in place and letting your hit points recover naturally. This also has the side effect that healing items are a lot less meaningful, whereas in NetHack they are very valuable. Healing items are dramatically useful to run into, and you hold on to them until you need them in NetHack, and you try and bless them so that they'll heal you for even more in a critical time so that you can keep moving forward so you don't starve to death. Whereas in Dreadmoor, healing items in general work differently. They make you regenerate health at a slightly faster rate. So again, you still have to sort of wait around and wait for your health to regenerate, but it's happening more quickly. But there's still really nothing forcing you to go forward. And that's a problem in Dreadmoor, because what you're saying, what this means is that the, you know, given that a player likely has the goal of beating the game, they will make choices that will make them more likely to beat the game and optimize towards that end. And it is optimal to wait and spend time telling your character to wait and get all their health back between fights. There is basically... The downside to this is extremely minimal.
Yeah. You know, it's honestly better when you design for that. And the solution in the case of Dreadmoor would be to acknowledge that waiting around for your health to fill up is the correct strategy, and then making it immediate.
Right.
Having something that says, okay, you are in a fight because you're close enough to whatever.
Yes.
Or, I mean, there's bound to be some like natural enough way to the game to determine whether or not you are in a fight. And if you're not, you're just pow, full healed.
Well, you can do it as something as simple as there are no monsters in your sight radius, and there are no monsters currently chasing you that have a path to you.
Okay, that's fine, but I don't care.
Right, okay.
My point with it is, if you design for that to be the case, then you'll make monsters a lot stronger.
Yes.
Every individual one of them will pose a serious challenge to the player, where if your plan for victory is to win with one of your hit points left, then that's a good plan. You know?
Yes. No, and
it would be an entirely different game. It would be totally
right.
Cutthroat.
And I've played other games that work like this, where your health regenerates extremely quickly in a matter of seconds. It acknowledges
you've won, rest up. Right. I'm coming from the dimension of Romancing Saga 3.
Yes.
Where after a fight, you just have full hit points.
Right.
Any life points that you lost carry over. And,
right.
You know, those
life point,
are a more
your more meaningful resources are your life points, your Waza points, your magic points.
Yeah.
And,
you know, but the health being, it wasn't just setting your health to some low amount.
Yeah.
But it was scaling monsters and encounters such that, yeah, you would die in many of the fights or get knocked out or whatever.
Yeah.
You lose all your hit points
in most of
the fights.
As it were.
Like, a lot of the time.
Yes.
Any given monster encounter could do this to you. They were all powerful enough. In most cases, some of the very first monsters that you encounter have abilities that will one-shot one or more of your characters.
Yeah.
Just be like, okay, no, this one hits you for all the bananas. Pow!
But it's
done.
Okay because, like you said, the game is designed for this.
Yes, it's designed for that. Dreadmoor is not designed for that. So even though it is effectively the case, it's not designed for that to be the case. So the game suffers.
Right. What Dreadmoor does a little better is that, like, needing specific items or defenses is a lot less of an issue, at least up until you get to the final boss, where good luck if you're trying to defeat him in melee.
I see.
Because he But that's, you know, sort of a minor detail.
If a game is set up to give you a plurality of options or a lot of choices, there should be more than one correct one.
Mm.
You know, if your game is designed with obstacles and goals, it's okay for there to be one correct one. Because it's the challenge of surmounting those obstacles that are obvious and understandable. But if your game is about choices, there ought to be more than one acceptable choice.
Yes.
And probably there should be several good ones, and best of all, there could be lots of them and offer like interesting alternatives for players of different play styles and different skill levels, even, and attitudes and everything. That would be great.
So NetHack sucks because there's too much bullshit information floating around that you need to know if you want to succeed. And Dreadmoor sucks because there's nothing forcing you to move forward. And you know what game doesn't have a lot of bullshit that you need to know, but still forces you to move forward, and is maybe one of the best dungeon games I've ever played? Want to know what game that is, Kaz?
I kind of do. It sounds
Pokemon
awesome.
Pokemon Mystery Dungeon.
Wait a minute.
I'm not even like kidding.
I feel like I've been tricked. What is this?
Pokemon Mystery Dungeon is, you know, it's in the Mystery Dungeon series of games, which started with Shiren the Wanderer on the Super Famicom.
Shiren, White Castle? Wait, hold on.
Yeah, you're trying to get to White...
You're trying to get to White Castle.
Which is an admirable goal and a good reason to go into a dungeon.
Yes,
And it's still grid-based and turn-based, and there's stuff that, you know, is randomized each time you enter a dungeon. But then there's a lot of stuff that isn't. And in Pokemon Mystery Dungeon, you both get hungry, and you need to find food. And also, you have another... Your attacks are another resource, because in the regular Pokemon games, you know, you have power points for each attack.
And
similarly, you have power points for each attack in Pokemon Mystery Dungeon. And so you need to get to special floors that are, you know, they'll say, you know, like, okay, in this dungeon, you get a rest every 3 floors or 4 floors or whatever. And when you get that rest, you get your power points back, and there are also special items that will do it. So it's also not good to just run around beating every monster you can find and fully clearing out the floor, because you might use up too many of your attacks. So we're again saying, don't methodically, you know, explore this full tree, because that's kind of tedious. You know, go at a good pace and try and get to the end of the dungeon. So by forcing you, both by forcing you to keep moving forward because you're hungry, and by, even if you have a lot of food, you still have power points keeping it from being a good idea to just, you know, go and methodically murder every living thing in the dungeon. What this design says is, your goal is to get to the end of the dungeon. And, you know, make it there. You know, survive to there. There might be a boss at the end.
Yeah, importantly, this is a method for the game to tell you this without literally stating this to you as the goal. Not like a dude who says, yo, you gotta get to the end of this here dungeon and let me explain to you in detail why. Right. I've installed an email program on the laptop that you are never without, just so that I can feed you these bits of useless information. Like this one. You have to get to the dungeon. Bottom. You do. For no reason. Now go do it. Right. Jerk. Take a couple steps.
And Pokemon
By the way,
dungeon.
I sent you another email. Are you ready for this one? I've spelled it out all caps, because I've just figured out the laptop caps lock key on my keyboard. Aren't you astounded? That's all. Oh,
well,
also,
later.
Put weights on things sometimes, but not other times, because then you'll die. Dungeons.
The dungeon is full of traps.
Pokemon
Mystery Dungeon, also,
badass.
The game is, like, broken up into many separate dungeons, so they can sort of start you off with short dungeons that are rich in resources, and can later move on to longer dungeons that have more complex monsters, more complex traps, and will require more complex strategies to complete successfully.
Yeah, so by splitting it up that way, that allows the designers a more careful reining in of the possibilities that the dungeon offers.
Right.
At any given step. This is really, really, really important to game design. Right. This is one of the fundamental weaknesses of the procedurally generated thing, is that you can't know exactly how a player is able to make it through these areas. So you have to figure out the, you know, either the max and the min of what they can and can't do, what they can and cannot have found by a certain point, or you can moderate the average, control for other limiting factors. There's a lot of work you can do to figure out what a player will be capable of or what they will have encountered by a certain point. And it's work that you have to do if you're going to randomly generate these things.
Yes. And the actual dungeons themselves in Pokemon Mystery Dungeon are procedurally generated. You're not going to get the same exact dungeon each time, but it's going to be like, okay, this next dungeon is going to be this many floors, and it's going to have this kind of stuff in it.
Yeah.
And so like, you have an idea of
what to
expect.
Splitting it up that way is, it gives them an easier job of controlling what you'll encounter.
Right.
And also you know, you'll have a better idea of what you'll encounter because they're broken up into smaller chunks, and you don't need to carry too much information with you as you go.
Yes.
You know, you can say, oh, I am in the water dungeon, I need water dungeon knowledge.
Yes.
And, you know, some
an
of
an electric type
over,
will serve me well here, you know.
Hopefully they also ramp up in complexity, as you say, by gradually teaching you different good things that are universal to dungeons, or perhaps the first one starts off with bits of complexity A and B, the second one is A and C, and the third one is A, B, and C, or something like that.
Something like that. They like, for example, traps are not in the first few dungeons.
Yeah.
The first few dungeons are mostly learning about moving around and exploring and slugging it out. But it's never sort of over your shoulder as an overt tutorial telling you, walk up to the monster, then pick an attack. It's like, okay, here's the dungeon, go. But all you need to do to win is walk up to the monster and pick an attack the first time.
Hmm.
But then that stops being quite so good, and you have to think, like, okay, what are my other options here?
Man, Pokemon Mystery Dungeon sounds like a freaking sweet spot.
Let me just chill this game a little harder. You can pick absolutely any Pokemon you like, and they will probably be pretty effective because of the way stat-ups work in this game. So it's not like, oh, you know, this Pokemon just has... their stats are too low. You know, pick a better fire type or whatever. If you like Arcanine, use Arcanine as your fire type. If you like Ninetales, use Ninetales. And because every Pokemon can take an infinite number of stat-up items, which have to be found in dungeons, but provide permanent, benefits to the Pokemon you feed it to. So, if you can very, very much play with just your favorite guys, and you will not be hamstrung because your favorite guy isn't high tier enough, the way you would if you went for a competitive Pokemon battle.
Ugh. I don't want to think about the competitive world of Pokemon for a long time.
No, you don't. What else? The game starts off gently enough that someone who's new to this whole dungeon stuff is not going to feel like they're in the dark, but there's optional endgame stuff that has driven me to tears. So there's challenge there, should you desire challenge. What else? There's the mechanism for getting new Pokemon is pretty neat. Well, actually, no, it's very, I guess, less neat and more straightforward. Which is to say, you beat a Pokemon, and maybe you get him. And there are ways to increase that chance.
Oh, so sort of a Final Fantasy 13 Pokemon thing.
Yeah. But it means that if you really want, you know, a certain Pokemon, and you've seen them in a dungeon before, well, you know, go in there, slap on your recruitment increasing thing, which they hand you pretty early because they realize it's important, and go to town, and you'll probably get it pretty quick. I just consistently had fun playing this game. It felt challenging, and I would be surprised, but no surprise ever felt unfair.
Well, you know what doesn't surprise me about the whole thing is that Nintendo is rather good at the kinds of things that we're describing.
Well, actually, who made...
carefully controlling the player experience and...
Let's see, who is actually responsible for the Mystery Dungeon series?
Aren't too hard. Yeah,
Mystery Dungeon
okay,
is actually developed by a company called Chunsoft.
Okay, never heard of them.
Basically, they've made the Mystery Dungeon
games.
They've
made this, and then they get slapped with the Nintendo, Pokemon, yeah. Game Freak branding.
Yeah, they also made Chocobo's Mystery Dungeon similarly. They make the Mystery Dungeon games. They made one themed off of Dragon Quest.
Yeah, doesn't surprise me at all.
Were you that merchant character from one of the Dragon Quest games?
Yeah, I think I played that for a couple minutes and then figured out that it wasn't a direct sequel of Dragon Quest. And I'm like, who the hell is this?
Yeah.
Why does a slime not draw near? What is this?
This is a different sort of game.
Yeah.
Mm.
Tormod's Quest? Not Tormod.
Tomeko?
I don't remember the guy's name, and I don't want to. Well, I don't want to just take open the internet here and look it up because that's.
So what I'm saying is that like there are all these dungeon games, and there are a lot of games modernly that say, "Oh, we've got procedural generation. It's never the same twice." I consider that a neutral feature.
Yeah, that's not like a positive selling point.
That is simply.
That
in
means you have a lot of work to do if you want this to be good.
Yes.
You know? Every game of Super Mario Bros. 3 that I play is different, even though all the levels are always exactly the same.
Mm.
Because I am different. I am the source of randomness in the game. I choose a different path. I get a different break off of a jump from a monster or whatever. And just by my, you know, raw inability to perfectly replicate one play experience from one time to the next, it is at least a little different, and often, just because of my attitudes or my feelings or, you know, how I'm doing that day, I do things differently. And it's still fun. It's fine. You don't need the game to procedurally generate something or roll dice to determine things in order to have a new experience at the game.
You can play the game in a different way, or maybe play it in a way you've already played, but it was a while ago. Maybe you forgot. And it'll feel like a new play experience. And if it feels like it, it more or less is.
Yeah, what more is there to dungeons than this?
What was it? So, a good dungeon game, if you are going to make a procedural dungeon game, make the parts controlled by the proceduralness pretty minimal. You know, we figure out how the rooms are lined up, and that's about it. We know that we want this toughness of this kind of monster and this kind of trap in this part of the dungeon, and we know this. And it won't be in the same place, but the player can learn, this dungeon has fog traps in it. I should be ready for that. And so we want, randomness is okay, but over-randomization is going to lead to unfun game states. And the other thing is we need something, if we want to encourage behaviors that do not waste the player's time. And we want to encourage... If we're saying the goal of the game is to get to the end of the dungeon, we should encourage behaviors that move the player towards the end of the dungeon.
Hmm.
And maybe we'd also like it so that, when things do happen at random and the dice come up just right, and you're a starting character, and you've just gone into, sort of a few floors down in the dungeon, and you find a gnome. That gnome just happens to have an attack wand. And that attack wand just... We rolled it. It happens to be a wand of death. And he happened to see you. And he happened to fire his wand of death at you. And the death ray happened to hit you. And you died. And there was really nothing you could have done about this. We don't want this to happen too often.
I think it's fun enough when it happens on occasion.
When it's very rare. You know, it's a funny story. The gnome with the wand of death got me. Ha ha.
He's like,
And it happens early in the game. You didn't lose too much time.
See, that would what I want to say to that is I don't care whether or not certain things are controlled by the procedure or not. I don't care if it's minimal. But if it's more than minimal, you'd better do your damn homework to control what can and can't happen in it. As far as
Spelunky.
Pushing the player onward and fucking not... I haven't played Spelunky.
Spelunky
it has a guy
likes
with...
to generate levels that are just like, oh, guess I don't have enough rope to beat this level.
Oh, man. Ooh. Yeah, that's actually just a base quality assurance failing. Like, oh, the
oh,
maze
say, oh,
doesn't
if you had
have
made
exits.
This jump Whoops. Right here, then you wouldn't have needed that rope.
Yeah.
So
I don't
really,
know about
you missed that,
but...
jump, and then you have to wait for the ghost to arrive and eat you.
Oh, hooray! This sounds like a game I don't want to play, but maybe
no,
we'll discuss
it
some other time after I have or played a demo or something. But okay, so there's two big things about dungeon games that I think should be in there.
Let's hear what
you've
got to say.
Reward things the player would do anyway, or that feel natural, you know? If it makes sense to the player to take an approach to the situation, or they, you know, you see your little test cases or whatever, if they figure something out and it doesn't work, maybe it should work. Maybe you, as the dungeon master, in air quotes for this, should say yes. You should say yes often as dungeon master. Not always.
Not always.
But often. Frequently. It's a fun moment when the player figures something out and it actually works. That's a very cool.
Player feels smart
moment.
And satisfied.
Your reward things that they do anyway, that sort of builds off of the don't waste their time.
Yeah.
You know, if they take their time dreaming up this solution, it should work. The other thing is, as far as the procedure goes, you should have a careful control of what is called entropy in random variables.
Mm.
Understand the entropy of any given circumstance. That is to say, the stakes, put another way. The highest entropy random thing is a coin toss. 50-50. This or that, and equal like weights on either side or whatever, and go. And that's it. Anything that is spread out or has a lump to it or a plurality of randomness, a bell curve, a triangle distribution, whatever, even like the distribution shape of 2d6 take the sum has a kind of predictability to it that players will pick up on without going open an Excel spreadsheet and rawly calculating all of the possibilities of things and then shaking their fists at the heavens when they had a, you know, 30% chance of success and that wasn't enough or whatever. So there are times to use high entropy and low entropy random circumstances, but you should understand that this is a thing and that you can control for it. Settlers of Catan is amazing this way. I can't say enough good things about that game for how it treats its use of random variables. Where, yes, sometimes it looks like a coin toss, but good players will consistently beat poor ones because, on average, it's weighted. You know, centers at 7, 6 and 8 are high. They even label those with the red color to indicate, hey, this comes up more often in the tossing of bones.
Dungeons. If you do want to make a high entropy dungeon game, that's not inherently bad, but don't make it a long one.
Yeah?
A really short high entropy dungeon game
could
be
have,
a really
could
fun experience.
Like, could we have something like NetHack, but it's one floor?
Yeah, but it's like crazy.
Yeah.
Because if the dice simply declare that I can't win this game, I've lost 30, 40 seconds.
You know, it was interesting, but you can say to your buddies how far you got in the floor even without that. It's like, yeah. Oh, then I discovered it was unwinnable, but up to that point I was like, ooh, this might be it.
Yeah, so, yeah, I guess Desktop Dungeons is sort of this, like, puzzle game that sort of operates off of that. I'll have to show that to you sometime.
Oh, well.
Because it is the one-floor dungeon.
We've just come across all kinds of things tonight. Kirby games and Kirby dungeon games.
Dungeon games, Pokemon games.
Roguelikes, Pokemon
roguelikes,
mystery
Pokemon
dungeon.
Likes, mystery likes.
Puzzles. Mystery likes.
I'm just putting like after everything.
I like likes.
Like likes?
I like likes. I heard Ike likes like likes.
Ike likes like likes.
Ike likes likes likes.
Do you like Ike?
I like Ike.
You like Ike who likes like likes?
I like Ike who likes like likes.
I don't know if I like that you like Ike that likes likes likes. Fuck, you win. That was good, though. That was good.
And that is how you bid likes.
God, my mouth hurts.
We should probably stop, then. I think we've said a lot about dungeons.
Go out and try dungeon games, but be very critical of them. As you should
extremely
be of all
critical.
Skulls.
Skulls.